Hi, this is Bill Radke, and you're listening to Weekend America's MP3 podcast, and there's nothing wrong with that. But did you know there's a way to hear all of Weekend America, plus see pictures, videos, skip forward and backward through stories with better sound quality? It's the Weekend America Enhanced Podcast. And to subscribe, search for Weekend America in iTunes or go to our website and click on Enhanced Podcast.
Coming up on Weekend America.
Economic slowdown is squeezing the American weekend.
Our bank account went from a couple of thousand down to, I think we have $21 right now in our savings account. And, I laugh about it because if you don't, you're going to cry.
We'll meet people learning to have adventures on a budget. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Also this hour, Iraq veterans are remembering their first day of combat.
Only a few hours into Iraq, I find myself with this mnemonic playing through my head, which is, we'd been told, if we see an AK-47, shoot it. And I came within a second of shooting a guy from Chicago.
A war turns 5 years old. And some people's perfect weekend involves a 9-iron.
I'm not interested in golf at all. In fact, I'm the world's most spastic person.
But he's applying golf's lessons to the mysteries of the body. That's on Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Layoffs and high prices for oil and food mean more Americans are having to decide between a need and a want. How do you know the difference? In a few minutes, we'll hear about a man who made an unwise purchase while he was living, but it was the purchase he supported after he was gone that changed the lives of his family. What's a purchase that has changed your life?
Something I bought that's changed my life is my cell phone. My cell phone went out last week, so I had to buy another cell phone, and I can't do without it.
Well, this might be kind of a dorky answer, but I guess my computer.
Maybe my iPod?
Airline tickets.
My house.
A minivan, because it really drove home the fact that I am now a proud father.
I just recently inherited my dad's bicycle, and that's pretty much changed my life. Stopped driving. And now I just ride around on the bike all day.
Bicycles and guitars, two things. Kind of helped define my identity.
That's funny. Selling my minivan helped define my identity.
Those voices came from Brooklyn, Atlanta, and Chicago.
Well, there's been a lot of news lately about the stalling economy. Gas prices are hitting an all-time high, and earlier this month, the Mortgage Bankers Association issued a report saying that foreclosure proceedings are at the highest levels since the organization started the survey in 1985. Leading the nation in delinquent loans is Mississippi, followed by Michigan, then Georgia. That's a lot of weekends filled with worry.
We're all feeling the pinch. High gas prices may not only be affecting your work week commute, but also how much you drive on the weekends. Here at Weekend America, of course, we wanted to know how the economy is affecting that part of your life, your weekend. How do you enjoy that time if you're low on cash?
My name's Eileen Neifenbisch. This is how my weekends are in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. My husband and I live in an 1890s old house with our mentally retarded adult daughter. My husband is a couple years younger than I, and Jim worked for a large company here in Lancaster that a couple years ago started closing its doors and laying people off, and he was one of the ones that lost his job in that transition. Since we live at home with our daughter, and I'm somewhat handicapped, it's not been easy to go out at our ages and find employment. My husband has looked for a job, but when you're in your late 50s and you go out and you try to find employment, even if you've been a terrific worker for 30-some years, nobody really is that interested in you. So as far as being able to go out and do things, it just isn't happening. One of the things that we don't have anymore is mad money or money to do things on a weekend. We don't have the cushions. Our bank account went from a couple of thousand down to, I think we have $21 right now in our savings account. I laugh about it because if you don't, you're going to cry, so you don't really have much of a choice. And of course, we sit in a house that we've lived in for 30 some years that has a lot of charm, and we love it. But at the same time, it has a old-fashioned heater because it was built in the 1890s. And the rise in heating oil prices has wiped out anything that we did have. The last time we filled up, we paid $3.58 a gallon for home heating oil. And when you, you know, put that into a 200-gallon tank and, you know, add a cold winter, you're doing that a lot. To do some things that are fun, we enjoy watching different programs, and we play games. We play a lot of Scrabble. We read a lot. Just be with friends and family. I enjoy really cooking for them. That's one of the things that disappoints me when I think about the downturn in the economy. Food prices have gone, for us, very, very high. And things like, you know, the nice old-fashioned Sunday dinner with family that you used to enjoy doing aren't really easy to do anymore. At least for us, they're not.
My name is Tom Griffith. I actually live in Los Angeles, California, but I'm the pastor of First United Methodist Church in Temple City, California, which is about 12 miles or so east of Los Angeles. One surprising thing about my job is the financial counseling that I've done. I was able to help one other minister who became disabled, and we worked out a rearrangement of her mortgage with her bank that would allow her to lower the payment. So it was interesting renegotiating a loan with a bank. When I'm preaching a sermon, sometimes I do talk about how the economy affects us and how do we try to live out our faith as well through our financial choices. And that sometimes we may need to think about what would be the best for the long term.
My name is Anna Hirsch, and Portland is one of the most fantastic places, I do have to say that, to live in when you don't have a whole lot of money in terms of having things to do. First of all, the food up here is amazing, and it's affordable. All the places that you go are really friendly, so we bring our cribbage board or a deck of cards, our little old granny games, and we go out and we play games at the bars, and you can just kind of make a night of it. There's a number of movie theaters here that have liquor licenses, so you can get beer, you can have pizza, and you can take it into the theater, and tickets to the movies are only about $3, and, you know, $1.50 on an amazing piece of pizza, you know, $2 on a beer, and you can go in and eat and drink while you watch the movie. And then Oregon is known for its outdoor activity as well, so there's just a lot to do here.
I'm Cindy Krieger from Lansing, Michigan. I don't spend as much time on my weekends visiting with family. I spend more time by myself doing things close to home instead of traveling out and visiting people. I probably drive 8,000 to 10,000 miles a year less now than I did a few years ago. I just don't feel that I can spend that kind of money that we have to spend for gas these days, and it shows when I tally up how much I've driven every year. Pretty much every weekend I would go visit somebody, and now I think twice before I hop in the car and drive off to see somebody. Well, I know I talk to my parents a lot more now than I used to. I talked to them last night for almost an hour, and I never used to call my parents and talk like that.
That was Cindy Krieger in Lansing, Michigan, Anna Hirsch in Portland, Oregon, Pastor Tom Griffith in Los Angeles, and Eileen Neefen-Bish in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Well, Bill, speaking about trying to make ends meet, last summer, Discover Financial Services surveyed Americans about what they'd have to give up if gas prices increased by a dollar. And 70% of the people said they'd cut back first on entertainment, and 64% said they'd postpone a major purchase. Well, those gas prices are edging closer to a dollar higher than they were last summer. And so I'm wondering, are people going to start making those choices now? Are they canceling vacation plans, taking public transportation, indefinitely postponing a major purchase?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the truth is some purchases are so important they just can't be delayed. So this weekend, we revisit a story from our series about purchases that changed people's lives. And it takes place in North Carolina, where we meet a mother and widow, Karen Tipps.
My name is Karen Tipps. I live in Winston-Salem with my daughter, Katie Rose. This is a story about a purchase Katie Rose and I made that has been terribly important in our lives. My husband and I rented a duplex when we were first married. At the time, I had a daughter, Katie Rose, who was 18 months old and had very recently been diagnosed with cerebral palsy. Shortly after she was born, he inherited some money, and he wanted to buy a house in Texas. And he went to Texas and bought the house. I didn't see it. So we got there, and it was a shack. It looked like a shack. It looked like an abandoned shack. It had no heat, no air conditioning, no appliances. It was very much like living... living outdoors. Everything came in, scorpions and snakes and tarantulas. And we had the water in the kitchen was through a hose that he stuck through the kitchen window. It was pretty dreadful. The thing about living in those conditions is that I had to get dressed up in business clothes every day and go into work. It was just a challenging way to live. In 1999, my husband died. He had lung cancer. There was not much time between the time he found out and the time he died. And he left $50,000 in an insurance policy. By 2000, Katie and I had bought a house. She loves her house. She just indicated in every way she can, by wiggling with squeals and whoops and smiles and laughter. Katie Rose and I no longer have to think constantly about how we're going to maneuver through the day. And that's a tremendous difference. We used to have to think very carefully about what it was we could cook on a hot plate, what the weather was going to be, so we could prepare by setting pots out or getting warm clothes out. We don't have to think so hard all the time about how we're just going to get through the day. We just have an ordinary life now, but it's precious to us because we've experienced an extraordinary life.
That was Karen Tipps, who now lives in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. This weekend, families there can enjoy something free, the 2008 Family Easter Fling at the Dixie Classic Fairgrounds.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
If your golf swing could sing, you could more easily hear the hitches. And if your body could sing, maybe you could hear the disease. That's next on Weekend America.
It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles, capturing what Americans are doing this weekend. And if you're playing golf, then you probably know the first rule is to maintain a respectful silence. But our next guest would like golf to make more noise than it does. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark introduces us to the composer and Stanford music professor who has become fascinated with the sound of trouble on the golf course and in the body.
This is a story about a musician who accidentally became a scientist. But before we get to either the musician or the science, consider, for a moment, the golf swing.
Oh, that was the wrong direction.
That wasn't where you were planning on it going.
No, over there, actually.
There are many approaches to mastering the golf swing.
I relax my grip just a little bit.
Keep your head down and keep your left arm straight.
Left eye behind the ball.
It's all in your hips.
It's all about timing.
As you start to flex your knees,
just swing and hope you hit the ball.
And they all sound like complete nonsense at first. It's that elusive je ne sais quoi.
The je ne sais quoi of the golf swing.
That's Amy Ladd. She's an orthopedic surgeon at Stanford University and sometimes golfer. And she's made it her mission to understand the science of the golf swing, from the twist of the wrist to the tilt of the anterior superior iliac spine. So she brought professional golfers to her motion laboratory and attached to their bodies and golf clubs dozens of small white markers.
They're about the size of, say, larger than a pea. Yeah, a blueberry. That's perfect size of a blueberry.
As the golfer swings, a computer calculates how the markers move through space. From that, Ladd figures out how the golfer's bodies move, too. But understanding the movement is the easy part.
You know, they call it in golf the sweet spot.
Teaching someone to find it, well, that's plagued golfers for almost 1,000 years. And that's where Jonathan Berger, the musician from Stanford, comes in. He's a friend of Amy Ladd's.
I'm not interested in golf at all. In fact, I'm the world's most spastic person.
But when he heard Ladd talk about the agony of watching someone try to learn a golf swing, it gave him an odd sense of deja vu.
I watched my daughters learn to play cello. And for any parent who's suffered that, it's agonizing. You know, it's total agony.
No.
Oh, bend your fingers, bend your fingers.
And then one day it clicks. One day they get it, right? You see this moment when a kid gets how to bow, and you realize that there's this incredible complexity in the wrist, in the muscles, in the forearm. Everything is complex, and it's all integrating in a certain way. And it only works because of auditory feedback. And so,
Berger, the musician, and Ladd, the golfing doctor, had a bizarre collective hallucination. What if he composed auditory feedback for the golf swing? So when you swung a golf club wrong, you made the same sort of horrible, horrible noises as a beginning cello player. Something like... And what if when all your muscles and joints did everything right, you made a pure sound? Distort the movements of the golf swing, the sound gets distorted too.
And the degree of the distortion is the degree of divergence from the sweet spot.
Berger calls this technique sonification. By sonifying the golfer's body, by putting it to music, he can reveal new information, new patterns.
So what I'm after is representing complex dynamic systems in sound.
This is not a new idea, Berger says. Sounds have always told us a lot.
The lawyer on Car Talk.
I've got a 93 Volkswagen Eurovan.
The click and clack, the Tappet Brothers. I mean, the first thing they always do is ask people to imitate the sound of what's wrong in their car, right?
And it goes like...
They actually have this language.
Does it make this noise when your foot is on the clutch?
You can take these musical terms and diagnose what's happening without opening the hood. We know that we have this intuitive, ingrained use of auditory cues. So that's a musical language.
A car has its own musical language. So do the cells in our body. This sound you're hearing now is the sonification of a benign colon cell. And this is the sound of cancer. Berger has been working with cancer researchers and mathematicians on non-invasive ways to detect cancer. Instead of doing a biopsy, you can do things like magnetic resonance imaging, MRIs. But the problem is, you get so much information that in a visual form, it's extremely difficult to separate the important data from the meaningless stuff. So Berger has assigned different sounds to different data points.
Imagine there's an orchestra of 100 players, right? And each of those points is mapped to one of those orchestra players.
Essentially, he's creating a symphony based on the information contained in the cells. And our ears can tell the difference between a benign symphony and a malignant one. But Berger is ultimately not a scientist. And so even the sounds of cancerous cells are beautiful to him. This is the music he made from them.
I don't think I would ever write in program notes that the sounds they're hearing are the sounds of malignant colon cells. But I was very much taken by sort of the... I thought they were very beautiful sounds. And I just made an orchestra out of different levels of healthiness of cells.
Maybe this weekend, you'll be listening to the hushed applause on the golf course at the Sony Open. Maybe you'll be listening to the churn of a washing machine or the clatter of plates at a diner. Whatever you're doing, Jonathan Berger reminds you to listen. What might those sounds be telling you? In Palo Alto, California, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
This weekend, Jonathan Berger is chauffeuring his daughter to a cello lesson so that she can produce more of those pleasing, harmonious sounds.
You know, Bill, this reminds me a lot of the idea of biofeedback, where if you can measure your heart rate or other body functions, then you can consciously control them. But here, instead of seeing the information, you're actually hearing it.
Right, and Berger has done all kinds of work with this. He has sonified Tai Chi movements and earthquake data. Mm. Now he's experimenting with the idea of sonifying magnified images of water droplets to assess water quality. And he's also using music to regulate patients' breathing as they undergo CT scans. And he has composed a violin concerto based on the contours of an oil spill in the Mediterranean 2 years ago. It's called Gia. It's been performed in concert halls, and you're listening to it now. And we have more about Jonathan Berger and his work at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
On the fifth anniversary of the Iraq War, soldiers think back to their first day on the front. Coming up on Weekend America. This is Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. The weekend has got its own feel to it, and for many of you, it's got its own song.
Yeah, like for me these days, jazz vocalist Liz Wright is my weekend relaxation buddy.
Yeah. I remember, wasn't Salt her first
album?
Right. I like Liz Wright. And this weekend, I'm going to be listening to a CD that a friend gave us, a folk rock singer-guitarist named Elizabeth Mitchell, who I know is not the actress on Lost. It's a different Elizabeth Mitchell. Otherwise, I just know it's children's songs that grown-ups might like.
Oh, like Jack Johnson's soundtrack to Curious George.
Right.
I bought that for myself a couple years ago. My kids are driving and paying taxes.
We've been asking you to share with us your weekend soundtrack, and we were psyched to hear from Tim Scanlon, singer-guitarist from the band Action Slacks. He listens to us in Los Angeles on KPCC, and it turns out his weekend soundtrack is Leave Them All Behind by the band Ride. Tim, why is this song your weekend soundtrack?
You know, the title of the song, Leave Them All Behind, pretty much says it all. And you can apply that to the micro level, you know, of leaving behind all of your day-to-day problems of the work week, and you can apply it to kind of a bigger level of, you know, leave the world at large behind. And that's really what the weekend is about for me. It's just kind of forgetting about the Monday through Friday things that I have to deal with and just get some peace of mind.
This song has got power.
I would encourage everybody to turn their radio up.
When do you like to put this song on?
Usually when I'm in the car with Aiden, my son, the soundtrack is limited to nursery rhymes. But when I'm in there by myself, you know, usually running an errand down to the hardware store to get something for the house, I'll put that on and just crank it up. I think I've actually have now blown out the speakers in my car.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Why does Leave Them All Behind speak to you so much?
It's like a kind of the musical equivalent of emancipation. You know, it just helps me forget about my immediate problems and just really focus on the now and enjoying life. It also kind of serves, you know, I am, for better or worse, in the music industry, and I work with music, and sometimes it can become commodified and get to the point where it becomes a widget, where you stop realizing or hearing, you know, the things about music that you loved in the first place. And this song serves to remind me of why I've devoted my life to music. You know, it's really kind of my religion. The lyrics are really simple. They're really only about 7 or 8 lines of words to the song. It's certainly words to live by. It's, you know, it's a sacred text for somebody whose life has been devoted to rock and roll.
Tim Scanlon of Pasadena, thank you so much for sharing your weekend soundtrack with us.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it. It was great talking with you.
I wonder if people know what just sheerly putting on a song of this energy can do for them.
I don't know. I think they should try it out. I think they should crank it.
Tim's song, Leave Them All Behind by Ride. What about you? What's the song that's the soundtrack to your weekend? And tell us the story behind it. Tell us the tale when you come see us at our website, weekendamerica.org. Now crank it. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and this weekend we are 5 years into the Iraq War. We marked that anniversary on Wednesday. So 5 years out, we've gathered together three people who served there and asked them to reflect. Brian Turner, Sandy Austin, and Dylan Tett were all stationed in Iraq, all with the Army. We asked them about their memories of their first day in combat and their last. We start with Brian Turner.
I remember the first day we were in Kuwait and we crossed the border on the 3rd of December 2003. And somehow out of the entire brigade, out of those several hundred vehicles or so, my platoon was in the very front. And so only a few hours into Iraq, I find myself with this mnemonic playing through my head, which is we'd been told, if we see an AK-47, shoot it. That was sort of a mnemonic to know who the enemy was, basically. And it was horrible advice because I found myself looking down the road and seeing a car on the left-hand side of the road, civilian car, with four guys off to the right of the highway. And they're each with an AK-47 hidden on the far side of their body. And I came within a second of shooting a guy from Chicago. These guys were contractors from the rear security element for a convoy far up the road that we couldn't see. They just stopped to take a leak, basically, I guess. And I almost shot the second one from the left. He had a big pot belly, and I had the little red dot on him, and I had the weapon on semi. I was ready to put my fingers on the trigger. I was ready to pull. And the guy to the left of him, very smart, he turned his body, and it caught the light. I saw something flash, but that wasn't going to stop me. But through my intercom, I heard the vehicle commander say, "Badge, I've got a badge." And that's what stopped me from shooting him. So that was I remember thinking, wow, this is going to be a really long year.
It's actually pretty amazing to me how different the experiences two people can have. Like just listening to Brian describe his first day, and then I'm looking here at my journal entry from when we actually arrived in Iraq, and it's just so different. But I should probably start by introducing myself. So I'm Sandy Austin, and I was a sergeant in the U.S. Army Reserve. As we were driving in, and I just want to reflect on this, so as I'm driving, I was, of course, a little afraid, and they prep you on IEDs, and if you're incoming fire, and you know, maybe this person next to you isn't going to be there tomorrow, so of course you have this internal fear, but you're kind of pushing that away so that you don't just dwell on being afraid, and for me, I was focusing definitely much more on reading my journal entry, what sounds so much more positive to me, and so here, we're driving in, and I'm noticing that we're passing all these small villages and that they're made up of these mud huts, and you see barefoot children, you saw men and women balancing baskets on their head. Anyway, so to me, I'm seeing this new nation, and I felt like a tourist seeing all of this, and I wanted to stop and meet these people. And I remember thinking, well, how are we supposed to make this functional democracy that we're supposedly here? And that's our job. That's our job. And here I'm looking here, and I'm like, do these people even want to be changed? So anyway, I was happy to be seeing such a different world. But underneath that tourist feeling was I was definitely afraid, and I was definitely hiding those feelings.
My first day in Iraq. My name is Dylan Tett. I was at the time an executive officer in the 5th Battalion, 20th Infantry Regiment. I remember this pretty well. Pulling out of Camp Udari, if you can imagine, hundreds of vehicles tracking mud over a street, a highway. A Kuwaiti car spun out of control after it had hit the mud that we had tracked onto this road. And there was a fatality, and the others were in serious critical condition. And we haven't even crossed the border yet and, in a way, caused this tragic accident. I also remember, and I have this picture hanging on my wall. It's a photo taken right before we crossed the berm into Iraq. And in the picture is myself, my driver, and my vehicle commander. And, you know, our uniforms are clean, our kit and our equipment was sparkling clean. I mean, compared to what would become of it, I mean, in a way, on the inside as well, you know, it was kind of our last moment before our lives would be changed forever. And I look at that picture now and I smile. And, it's neat.
Oh, can I ask Sandy a question real quick? I was just going to ask, what kind of vehicle were you driving?
We were in a Humvee, just a regular. It wasn't even...
It wasn't up armored?
No, it wasn't up armored.
Yeah, you guys were the ones that I remember thinking, man, you guys are brave, because we were in, you know, the Striker, and I was really confident. Later, we were hit by an RPG in it, and it just proved to me how strong they were, you know.
Crazy. But, yeah, I was actually the second vehicle in the convoy. But later, when we were in Iraq, we actually drove SUVs for a little bit. We weren't even in a Humvee. And then when I was home on leave, my team got hit by an RPG in an SUV. So that was kind of crazy.
Yeah, and when we were in that first vehicle, and I did say it was very tense in a lot of ways, and we were sort of amped up, but we had jerry-rigged the intercom system in the vehicle so we could play music and stuff. So some of the guys' CDs and stuff, we were playing through there. And Sergeant Zavala, my counterpart, he was in the back, I remember at one point, singing songs in Spanish with no musical accompaniment, you know, and it really kind of calmed people down, you know.
Yeah, that's true. We did the same thing. Soldiers are alike, you know. We had AC/DC or pumping through the intercom, which was a big no-no.
I was in Iraq from 3rd of December 2003 to just before Halloween of 2004.
I was in Iraq from December 03 to October 04.
I was in Iraq from December 03 until October 2004.
I departed Iraq via a C-130.
So my memories of my last day in Iraq.
The last 2 days I was in Iraq, I worked on this one poem. So should I read the poem?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's called Night in Blue. At 7,000 feet and looking back, running lights blacked out under the wings and America waiting. A year of my life disappears at midnight. The sky a deep viridian. The house lights below, small as match heads burned down to embers. Has this year made me a better lover? Will I understand something of hardship, of loss? Will a lover sense this in my kiss or touch? What do I know of redemption or sacrifice? What will I have to say of the dead? That it was worth it? That any of it made sense? I have no words to speak of war. I never dug the graves in Tel Afar. I never held the mother crying in Ramadi. I never lifted my friend's body when they carried him home. I have only the shadows under the leaves to take with me, the quiet of the desert, the low fog of Balad, orange groves with ice forming on the rinds of fruit. I have a woman crying in my ear late at night when the stars go dim, moonlight and sand as a resonance of the dust of bones, and nothing more. So I wrote that poem as if I was already on that plane. But that's what I spent doing, just sitting there. Guys were playing cards, you know, joking, talking about what they were going to do back home, what girls they were hoping to hook up with, or you know, what clubs they were going to go to, you know, all kind of, what they were going to drink first or eat first, that meal that they've been imagining for a year, you know, that kind of thing.
I have a little comment on that too, just about touching down. To me, that's like the real, when you actually feel everything. So we landed in North Carolina, and so nobody's family was really there, but we had this whole group of people there to greet us, and they were playing the Star Spangled Banner, and we all stood there, and I just remember crying. Ooh, gonna get me all teary right now, but it was just such an amazing feeling, like, to actually be on your own soil.
Yeah.
Ooh, sorry about that.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, but then here's the funny part. So we get off the plane, and they're playing the Star Spangled Banner, and there's a bass drum, which I must say, they need to leave the bass drum out of the Welcome Home Star Spangled Banners, because every time they would hit that, it would just kind of make you jump like it was a mortar coming in. Or anyway.
Yeah.
I departed Iraq via a C-130, which is an aircraft cargo plane, and I remember sitting at the airfield in Mosul, and a report had come about some kind of rocket activity or missile activity, and we did a near vertical takeoff. But I remember as my body was leaving the earth, this enormous rush of relief come over me. I was, in the back of my mind, I had this self-inflicted prophecy that I was going to be replaced by my newborn son, who was born while I was in Iraq, and we were supposed to share the same birthday. And I just felt that it was paranoia, but, you know, he would do the things that I never got to do. And, you know, as I left the ground, it was kind of the last check. that said, you know what, I survived and I'm not going to be replaced. It felt good. It felt really good.
I just got a phone call from a guy that was in my squad. He asked me to give him a recommendation if I got called for a security clearance because he wants to work for Blackwater.
Whoa.
He could be someone coming in on this weekend. And he's going in a very different way than what we've been talking about. And I told him not to get insert expletive shot. Don't get yourself shot over there.
Good advice, Brian.
Yeah, you know? and this relates to our last day in Iraq, because our last day in Iraq is also sort of tied to our first day back in America. Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
or
yes.
Back home, in a way. I remember there were retirees, World War II vets, and they shook our hands. And they didn't say anything about the war, if it was good or bad or whatever, any of that kind of thing. They just said, you know, welcome home. And that's a lesson we've learned since Vietnam, you know, of how do you treat the warrior regardless of where you may stand politically.
Former Army soldiers, now civilians, Brian Turner, Sandy Austin, and Dylan Tett. The Iraq War turned 5 years old this week. Brian Turner blogged for the New York Times about the eventual end of the war, wondering who will be the last soldier to die. He wrote, "Who can say where that last soldier is now, at this very moment? Kettleman City, Turlock, Wichita, Fredericksburg, Omaha, Duluth. She may be in the truck idling beside us in traffic as we wait for the light to turn green. He may be ordering a slice of key lime pie at Denny's, sitting at a booth with his friends after bowling all night. What name waits to be etched on a stone not yet erected in America? Somewhere out in the vast stretches of our country, somewhere out in Whitman's America, out among the wide expanse of grasses, somewhere here among us, the last soldier may lie dreaming in bed before the dawn as the sun sets over Iraq." The words of former Army Sergeant and poet Brian Turner. You can find links to these words and other segments we've done on the war in Iraq, and more of Brian Turner's poetry, all at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Many people are calmed by the sound of violins, but one military wife finds peace in making them. Meet her next on Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
From American Public Media, we hope you're enjoying your weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Weekends can be hard when a spouse is at war, but the Pentagon reported earlier this month that the divorce rate in the armed forces is actually holding steady at 3.3%. That's a bit lower than the national average. The military says their marriage support programs are what's making the difference. Corinthia Klein is a Milwaukee mom who managed kids alone while her husband spent a year and a half in Iraq. How'd she keep her sanity? Making stringed instruments, violas, cellos, violins. Sarah Lemanchik spent a Saturday with Corinthia, who says working with wood helps keep the stress of war at bay.
There's barely room for two people in Corinthia Klein's studio, and my head keeps bumping into one of the violins hanging from the ceiling, and I keep hoping Corinthia doesn't notice. She's standing over a desk in a t-shirt and shorts and making a tiny pile of sawdust.
A millimeter is like a mile in violin making. I like the process. I like actually sharpening my tools, and there's just something wonderful about being able to impose your will on the wood, and you get to make your own ideas pop out.
Corinthia apprenticed under a master violin maker for a number of years and spent time working in a repair shop, and then, finally, began to build her own. She was a music major in college, but she found that she enjoyed making violas more than playing them.
It doesn't mean anything to you if I tell you I played some piece fabulously yesterday. I have to do it again today. And it's disappearing as you're doing it. And that it has, it's definitely rewarding in its own way, but to have something done at some point is wonderful.
Klein builds about half her instruments on commission. So as soon as one is finished, there are another half dozen in the wings.
So I've got my wood picked out for this one. And this is actually a Guarneri 1737 model that I've done before that I'm looking forward to doing again.
That's 8-month-old Quinn waking up from a nap. Most instrument makers are not constantly interrupted by wailing infants or demands for popsicles. But since September 11th, Corinthia knew her normal days were numbered. When she married Ian, he was in the reserves, but it wasn't a big part of their lives. Now, his service is at the center of her world as a single mom. Over the past year and a half, he's been back only once, for Quinn's birth.
I asked him, you know, half jokingly before he left, if he was looking forward to getting back to Iraq where he could get some sleep. He said, yeah. He said, it's much quieter there with the mortar fire than it is here with the baby and the kids.
Can I take the water upstairs?
Tell you what, let's put it in a cup with a lid, and then you can take that upstairs, okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Ian tells her she has the harder job, and it's a lonely one, too. Corinthia says it's almost impossible to find any been-there-done-that camaraderie, except for her grandmother, who was in a similar situation during World War II.
It's exhausting, and it's frustrating. She's a sympathetic ear, and she understands in a way. I mean, you know, when other people say, wow, I can't even imagine that, well, she can. So she'll, you know, if I call and I'm crying and I'm just saying, you know, this is just hard. And she would just say, I know. And I know she does. So that means the world some days.
And some days, not even that is enough. Because while Klein believes in her husband's service, she doesn't believe in the war he's been sent to fight.
I mean, every day that I worry that if something happened to my husband, you know, I'm trying to imagine looking at my kids and saying, well, but at least he did it for, and then I wouldn't know how to finish the sentence. It's very distressing to not be able to feel confident about why we're sacrificing what we're sacrificing. It's very, very upsetting.
I'm going to play with him.
That's 5-year-old Aiden, Corinthia's oldest.
And I'm also going to want him to play with me and have horsey rides with me.
Does he give good horsey rides?
Mm-hmm. But my dad is really good at horsey rides, and my mom isn't so good at them.
I'm quite sure I'm the only shop in town with an Easy Bake Oven in it, along with all my finger planes.
Corinthia's studio, with its cramped quarters and waiting stacks of wood, has become more than a source of income and a place to ply a centuries-old trade. It has become her connection to her old self, or rather, a self that has nothing to do with the military or motherhood.
I've made a real point of trying to get back in there whenever possible, and so it's some element of myself that's still here, that I've preserved in a corner of the house, and, you know, I'll stay up the extra hour, you know, between midnight and 2 and just do something, you know, and I feel more like myself, which has been a real saving grace for me.
After figuring out how to make their life work without Ian, Corinthia was a little worried about what would happen when they actually had Ian back. Would they still all fit together in the same way? Ian told her to, basically, knock it off. Their old life is over, and he's ready to start a new life with her. They're going to open up a joint retail establishment. Corinthia's half selling violins and cellos with a real studio in back, and Ian's half to be filled with the clicks and whistles of model trains. And probably Aiden's Easy Bake Oven, too. In Milwaukee, I'm Sarah Lemanchuk for Weekend America.
Corinthia's husband is now back from Iraq. Pictures of Corinthia and her stringed instruments in progress are at our website. Go to weekendamerica.org.
That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. We're glad you spent it with us. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, Jim Gates, Millie Jefferson, E. Okobi, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Susie Lechtenberg, and Tim Bomba.
Also, Johnny Vince Evans, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, John Moe, Shirley Shin, Michael May, Sandon Totten, and Mark Sanchez.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. And there's a great way to listen to it. Just go to our website and get a free enhanced podcast. Ability to skip around from this story to that story and see links, images, photos, information. It's all at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. For those of you who celebrated, happy Easter. Hey, get out and enjoy the first weekend of spring.
Weekend America is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness online at loveandforgive.org and made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul. And made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
On the next Weekend America, music is such an important part of the weekend. Some of our best memories are tied to a song.
To this day, when I hear the Youngbloods play Let's Get Together, I close my eyes and I'm back in 1970 on top of a Ferris wheel overlooking the grounds of 50,000 hippies.
Maybe best isn't exactly the right word. The Youngbloods, A Dream Girl, and 50,000 Hippies on the next Weekend America. Join us.